You want Mari? Mari. I want to thank everybody for coming tonight and joining us here for a special lecture. Most importantly, I want to extend a hakarat hatov and a special thanks to our Aksanya, to Juliet, and also to Torin, who is not here. This shiur is sponsored and hosted in memory of each of their mothers. It's in memory of Ellen Shanzer, Ilana Bat Yisrael, and Anna Rutner, Sarah Bat Yom Tov, both of their neshamot Shirav Aliyot, and just thank the Rutners for being so gracious in hosting us and continue to take part in these great school events. This morning we read Parshat B'Shalach, and tucked in at sort of the very end of the Parsha, after Kriyat Yamsuf, we have the war with Amalek. And during the war with Amalek, we're told that Bnei Yisrael was successful as long as Moshe's hands were held up by Chor and by Yoshua. The Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah mentions that. And the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah asks, it says, but could the hands of Moshe make war or lose war? It's like, what was the cause and what was the effect? And what the Mishnah concludes, it says it, and even the Tosfot Yom Tov adds, really, that as long as Israel was looking upwards, not really them looking with their eyes, but really having their hearts facing upwards towards Hashem, then they prevailed. And when the hands fell, when we weren't thinking of Hashem, that Hashem was really guiding everything, they failed, really. And that's really a great analogy, sort of perfect that was this week's Parsha, because our kids don't have the benefit of Kriyat Yamsuf. Yet, we must inculcate with them the same level of emunah and faith in Hashem. Our yeshiva, the Ray Kushner Yeshiva High School, and the lower school, the Joseph Kushner Hebrew Academy, Yeshiva Beit Yosef, our faculty provides our children with the education, inspiration, and motivation. We are grateful for the Mesirat HaNefesh that our faculty provides. They dedicate their waking hours to our children. Among the gems of our faculty is Rabbi Svi Sinensky, who's here and giving the lecture tonight. Rabbi Sinensky is the Director of Interdisciplinary Learning and Educational Outreach at the Ray Kushner Yeshiva High School, where he also teaches Judaic study classes, collaborates with faculty to deepen the culture of interdisciplinary student learning throughout the school, and develops educational outreach programs for the school's families and partner communities. Rabbi Sinensky previously served as the Rote Beit Midrash of Kohelet Yeshiva High School in Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, and as rabbi for the Albert Einstein College of Medicine Synagogue. Rabbi Sinensky is a popular lecturer and author. He completed book-length treatments of the Jewish return to Tzion during the Second Temple period and the mitzvah of Torah study, published by Yeshivat Haaretzion's virtual Beit Midrash, and is now completing a series on Shir HaShirim. He serves as editor of the popular Lehrhaus website on Jewish thought and is pursuing a PhD in the Department of Modern Jewish Philosophy at the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies. His interdisciplinary high school course on Jewish and Western philosophy and the humanities was awarded the inaugural Kohelet Prize. Without further ado, I'd like to present to you Rabbi Sinensky.
Thank you, Bennett, so much. I also want to echo your words and postman b'chod achsanya. I want to thank the Rutner families, and I want to join together with you in recognizing your generosity. Just last year, I had the opportunity to spend Shabbat here. It was a wonderful Shabbat here in the community, and as it happened, we are here. And I think your husband was here that time, and I think you were in Israel at that time. So it's the one place better you could have been than West Orange was you were in Israel at the time, and now we've really gotten to know your entire family had the opportunity to learn together with your son last year on a very regular basis, and this year less regularly. We have to daven together, though, so the classes work. I have a current Talmud who's here as well. And the two of you and really your entire family really really exemplify the values that we seek to inculcate within the children in JKHA, our KYHS. And so it really is an honor and pleasure. And we are dedicating our learning in memory of Ellen Shanzer, Ilana Bat Yisrael, and Anna Rutner, Sarah Bat Yom Tov. I also want to thank Deegan, Bennett Deegan, sorry, excuse me. Call you. That's not the first. That's probably also not the, probably other things that you've been called, we've all been called. That's okay. But we, but the truth is that Bennett has been a tremendous, really a champion from before I even stepped into the school community, really from day one. You've really been incredible. And, so much of that which we have here tonight is really due to your just taking the lead on everything. It's really, extraordinary. Really feel, honored and privileged. It's really very much, appreciated. I want to recognize my colleagues who are here. I wonder if we have a number of them. I'm not going to go through all the names, but it means a lot. So we really have a very warm and collegial, environment, the relationships among the various faculty members and staff members and the leadership of the school is something that's indicative of the kind of culture that we have. And so it's really a tremendous pleasure to have a number of scholars who are here, part of the school community, including as well one who was here over the course of Shabbat. So it's a pleasure to be learning together with all of you this evening. Our topic is, as you see, science and Torah in the 21st century, beyond Genesis and the Big Bang. And it's actually quite fascinating. You'll take a look. We're going to mention a number of sources outside with regard to how we resolve some of these contradictions. You'll actually note that there aren't all that many sources on the actual sheet about that. And I'm going to explain exactly why that is by way of a short story. A couple of weeks ago, or it's actually maybe it's 2 months ago now, we had a really an extraordinary program in the high school. And we had no less than 28 of our high school students actually stepped up, volunteered their time to learn sources about exactly this topic. We're studying Bereishit, Chumash Bereishit in our Chumash classes this year. So it's a perfect opportunity. Students had been asking questions about Torah, the age of the universe, evolution, science, and so on and so forth. And so students stepped forward and they said, what can we do to perhaps create a program that would be meaningful? And we worked together with the students to create really a two-pronged program. These 28 students volunteered their time, learned together with me and others over the course of lunch, and then had this source sheet, and they taught actually chaburo to one another, to their peers. They taught in small groups, and it was really extraordinary to see the leadership of our own students really taking that forward. And then we had an entire panel where we opened it up really to the, we literally the entire school, first we had 9th, 10th grade, 11th, 12th grade, with chairs of Tanakh department, Gemara department, other teachers from the school, chair of our science department, Dr. Stevenstein, others as well. And there was really an opportunity for students to ask the whole gamut of questions. And over the course of working together with the students over those lunches and hearing the questions that they posed at that panel, I had the opportunity to be the moderator. So that's I just held the microphone and handed it over to students. It was really my colleagues and the students themselves who took the leadership. One of the things that I noticed was that there was perhaps a paradigm shift over the course of the last number of years. When I was growing up, I still recall that, at least for myself, peers, young people, the question as to how to reconcile the apparent contradictions between the Torah's presentation of creation, the story of Bereishit Perek Aleph on the one hand, and modern scientific assumptions in terms of evolution, age of the universe, and so on and so forth. We were really, at least I don't know if there are others here, perhaps this is representative of your experience as well, but for me and for some others, it was like a vexing question. We were really perturbed by it. We wanted to know, how do we resolve these difficulties? And the answers, and there are so many, were ones that we were really wondering about. How does this all fit together? And so we learned all sorts of different explanations that we heard. We heard about the possibility that the 6 days of creation are, of course, not literal days. And one that we're many of us are familiar with, and one that goes back hundreds upon hundreds of years. And after all, as my students have pointed out in my classes, we know that the notion of a day prior to the existence of the sun is quite scientifically problematic. So the notion that, as is very intuitive, that a day is not literally meant to be taken as a day, that was really enlightening for us. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. At least for me, that was something of a novelty. Similarly, other explanations as well. There are midrashim that claim that, in fact, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, created worlds and destroyed worlds. Created worlds and destroyed worlds, many of which may have preceded the story of creation and or actually represented by those 6 days of creation. And so again, another possible explanation, and I still recall in terms of the explanation of the fossil findings and so on and so forth, that was a possible explanation. In the 19th century, there was a great commentator on Mishnayot, the author of the Tiferes Yisrael, Rav Yisrael Lipschitz, who essentially asked questions. They brought to him questions. He was living through the time of the woolly mammoth finding, all these sort of discoveries of the fossil findings, etc. And they came to him, they said, Rabbi, how do you understand this? He delivers an entire drusha, what we call the drush or hachayim, which was then incorporated into his sections of his Mishnayot. I believe it was censored out. Dr. Shapiro can fill us in terms of the later editions, but in the original, I can tell you, that it was there. And so he begins to answer these questions, and he takes many of these ideas and he applies them to many of these sources in terms of trying to explain how it is that we can reconcile the difficulty of it being, as we see here on the sheet, the year 5780, according to the Jewish calendar, and we are 14 plus billion years of our way in to the universe, according to the findings of modern science. And these are things that really were questions for us, and these are just some of the answers, and we know that there are many more. And then we picked up books, such as the book entitled Genesis and the Big Bang, Nathan Aviezer. It's a classic. He now has Fossils in Faith as well. Other authors who address these kinds of questions, physicists, scientists, and ones who try to really give explanations that sought to find a concordance, sort of almost an equation, between the psukim, the meaning of the verses in Bereishit, and the findings of modern science. And this is something that I discussed extensively with many of my students. What does it mean, tohu vavohu? What does it mean that the world was chaos? What does it mean, v'ruach elokim rachefet al p'nei tahom? What does it mean that the Spirit of God hovered over the deep waters? What is this primordial light that the Kabbalists, and the Midrashim and the Kabbalists pick up on this, that there's some primordial light after all, just like we can ask, what does it mean for there had been a day prior to the creation of the sun? We can also wonder, what does it mean exactly for there to have been light? Is it possible? Many of my students have suggested, and I learned back then, that in fact, maybe that's a reference to the Big Bang. Is that possible? And so this has been suggested and debated. Is this a convincing way of reading the text? Is this not a convincing way of reading the text? And for me, I remember learning Bereishit Perek Aleph was almost an exercise in trying to determine the degree of concordance between the findings, the assumptions of modern science, and that which we read in the Psukim. And so our attention was really very much drawn to these questions. Tohu vavohu, and vayihi or, and the creation of the sun. And what does it mean that there was light, and so on and so forth, all these kinds of questions, and is evolution consistent with, is it not contradicted by Paragalith, Fabricia, etc.? And all that was interesting to the students of today, I found, my students we had been learning, except they weren't perturbed, most of them, overwhelmingly. I can't speak for all, obviously, but I found a shift. And I find this elsewhere as well, and I've seen this among others that I've discussed it with, almost as if, you know, at this point, and I can't speak for anyone in the audience, but I can speak kind of myself. I almost feel like I've undergone this shift, and I see this with many, again, of my Talmidim, my Talmidot, is that it's almost kind of taken for granted. We're comfortable with this assumption. It's kind of like, yeah, of course, evolution, age of the universe, these are not controversial issues in the modern Orthodox community writ large anymore. We can always find exceptions to the rule in other parts of the Orthodox community. So it's a different kind of question, but I really think it's fair to say that at this point, that's sort of become the standard. And we have statements, we have teachings that I remember learning initially and being really taken by that are kind of, I think, taken for granted by your students nowadays. For example, take a look at source number one, comments by Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch was one of those who's writing in the middle of the 19th century. So Darwin is publishing The Origin of Species, writing about these very controversial and difficult questions. Christians, Jews, people of other faith, and just other individuals trying to grapple with these issues. And you know, I remember reading Rav Hirsch, even if evolution were to gain complete acceptance by the scientific world, because of course he's writing at a time prior to the universal acceptance of evolution as a as an accepted scientific theory, Judaism would call upon its adherents to give even greater reverence than ever before to the one sole God. So Rav Hirsch here is saying, wait a second, we don't have to assume that evolution is contrary to Jewish thought. Instead, we can come in with the assumption that, in fact, these are completely not only consistent, that there is concordance, as it were, between the two, but more than that, that in fact, if evolution is the mechanism that God brought into the universe to bring forth the development of life, and so that gives us deeper appreciation for the brilliance of God and for the mechanisms that he has put in place for us to appreciate the way that the world has come to come to the shape and the design, as it were, that we have that we encounter today. So sources like Rav Hirsch, and I think that statement that was put out in 2005 by the Biblical Council of America, I think is very telling. You can take a look online. They have these resolutions that they put out from time to time. I just took two sentences from it, but I think it's really representative of where we are today. This is obviously 2005. Significant Jewish authorities, they're arguing. In other words, they're granting that there are others who disagree, but the RCA, an umbrella organization of over 1,000 rabbis in North America, concludes that significant Jewish authorities have maintained that an evolutionary theory properly understood is not incompatible with belief in a divine creator, nor with the first two chapters of Genesis. So I think it's really fair to say that if 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, perhaps things were a little bit different and there were more people kind of vexed by these questions, grappling with these questions, we have plenty of questions nowadays. But I'm not sure that science and Torah, I think it engages our students. I think it's extremely interesting to us. We're here tonight. These are fascinating sorts of topics. But I'm not sure that we come in, again, I can't speak for everyone here, but I can certainly speak my experience personally with my students, and I'm not sure that we're necessarily coming in with that sense of, wow, how does this work, and is this really compatible, and, you know, what about those dinosaurs that my parents brought me to, you know, to see in the museum, and like, I learned Chumash, and then I went to the museum, and like, how does this all fit together? I just haven't heard the question from my students about the dinosaurs. Like, they're just not bothered in the same way by that anymore. And I think that that's a really interesting shift. I think there are a number of reasons for it, but what I want to explore a little bit this evening is to ask ourselves the question, well, what then? What next? Right? If we've kind of come to the conclusion as a community, we can always delve deeper, we can always try to understand, but if we are confident that one way or another we can resolve these contradictions, so then why is there still interest, and where do we go from here? We just say, okay, we took care of that one, we're on to the next question. Or is it possible that having found answers, having found a certain comfort level with these issues, it actually allows us the opportunity to revisit the text, to revisit some of the scientific theories, and to actually consider them from a different vantage point altogether. If it's true that we no longer struggle with how it is that evolution could possibly be consistent with Torah, or we accept to kind of take that for granted, so what then? Once we take evolution for granted, is that just separate from Judaism and has nothing to do with us? Sort of as Rabbi Sacks or Jonathan Sacks wrote a book on this just a few short years ago, and he calls it The Great Partnership. And so for Rabbi Sacks, it's sort of, as we say in Hebrew, science l'chud and Torah l'chud. Science is its own question and Torah is its own question, a different area of study. Science asks the question as to how the world works, and Torah is asking us how we're meant to live our lives. Is that what we say? Or is it possible that we can now take new steps and kind of take a fresh perspective on what it is that the Torah is trying to tell us? If I was reading Bereishit Perek Aleph as just a few short years ago, grappling with the question, only able to see it through the lens of, okay, where does the science fit in? Well, is it possible that we can look at Bereishit Perek Aleph and indeed Sefer Bereishit, the opening chapters of Sefer Bereishit, through a new lens? Is it possible that in light of evolution, we can now reconsider some fundamental questions in Jewish thought, or I would say to recover some classical sources that maybe perhaps we would have previously overlooked in light of some of the concepts of evolution? And before I jump into the example of evolution, which I want to give, I just want to start with just one example of just to get us thinking about this, of where this might be of interest and of significant value. It's thinking about this in context of the meaning of Shabbat. The meaning of Shabbat. We all know that we read the Psukim, and so Shabbat is the seventh day of creation. Hashem rests on the seventh day, right? So if our only question was, okay, how do we resolve the apparent contradictions? So then I understand. But what if we start to ask ourselves the question, okay, granted, we're going to go with the view that maintains that the days of creation are metaphorical. They're not meant as literal days. Okay, fine. So what does it mean that Shabbos was the seventh day? How do we understand that? Stop and think about that. Now, so long as I'm only interested in asking the question of how do I solve this problem, I'm not going to ask that question. Because all I want to do is to make sure the Torah is no longer under attack from these new philosophies, from these new ideas, or relatively new ideas. And so until I'm satisfied how we've defended the faith successfully, and now we can move on. But what happens when we accept that? And now we try to understand more deeply, okay, let's grant that we're going to make certain assumptions. What then? Right, so obviously we have the idea of Shabbat, obviously we keep it on the seventh day. But for example, is there a notion of rest? Is there a meaningful notion of rest that goes beyond the day of Shabbos? Right? Is it intrinsic to the seventh day of the week? Or is it that God sought to teach us that after a week of work, there's a notion of rest and there's a value to that? And it's a question that's very interesting because it actually had certain ramifications. The Gemara talks about a question that perhaps some who have, if anyone's been stranded on an island before, anyone, not the only one, who has had that experience, the Gemara actually talks about the case of a mehalich bamidbar. The Gemara wants to know, what happens if someone's traveling on Shabbat and doesn't know what day of the week it is, before the advent of the iPhone, and so, like, just put totally no idea, and, like, no way to communicate, you know, what are the three things you would bring? My phone, so most people think that it also provides physical nourishment nowadays, but that's how we do it. It really is an extension of this. It's unbelievable. We actually had at lunch today with a very thoughtful psychologist, as it happened, and we came up to the question of technology and said, how does it impact on your practice? And she says, yes, because everyone's sleeping with their phones, and it's completely transformed the implications for so many of the challenges, and it's just the way the lifestyle is so interesting. And she was saying that this has really impacted in terms of her practice. So the question, though, you come back to you're on the island, right? And the Gemara wants to know, in the Gemara's case, it's actually mehalich mamidbar. Someone gets lost in the desert. So what do you do? So the Gemara says, interestingly enough, the Gemara says, well, actually two opinions in the Gemara. One opinion is we're in Shabbat, daf samach cherem abed, 68b. The Gemara, one opinion is that you actually observe the first day as Shabbat, and then you count 60 days from there, interestingly enough. That's actually consistent with the view that Adam HaRishon was created right before Shabbat, in which case it would have been at the beginning of the week, so like Adam HaRishon, so we have that experience. The other opinion says no, that we follow our contemporary experience. 6 days, in the way the Torah describes creation. 6 days, and then you keep Shabbat. So this Gemara is a whole debate about this, and how do we handle this? So it's interesting. The Gemara actually concludes that such an individual, one way or the other, should observe a day of Shabbat, even though I have absolutely no idea what day it is. Why? Right? Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Shabbat, each and every one of those days is equally significant in terms of its status as a day of rest. Why should I choose one day over the other? So the Gemara says, well, you shouldn't forget. Shelo tishtakach torat Shabbat. You shouldn't forget about the concept of Shabbat. Sounds like the Gemara is saying, really, we don't know. But when you get back to civilization, you get back, you find your iPhone again, right? So then you're going to be able, I happen to have an iPhone, so I don't mean to, if anyone's Android or anything, I don't want to, certainly don't want to choose sides, but be that as it may. So the Right? So what do you do? So the Gemara seems to say, well, see, you don't want to forget about the concept of Shabbat. But if you go to the 15th century, there's a responsum of Rav David ben Zimra, the Radvaz. Radvaz is writing in the wake of many of the questions emerging from transportation at that time, and the international dateline, and these sorts of things. And people are asking him and saying, wait a second, you're telling me that if I live in Egypt, and I live in a different country, I live somewhere else, I live in Europe, wherever it is, that we're keeping Shabbat, we're starting at different times, we're just starting to dawn on them, the notion of international dateline and all these kinds of problems that we're quite familiar with nowadays with mass transportation and so on and so forth. And so, mass communication. So the Radvaz actually references this Gemara and he says it's okay. And he actually explains that the Gemara in Shabbat doesn't just mean to say that we don't want to forget about Shabbat. He actually says that every single day has an aspect of the sanctity of Shabbat. Every single day has an aspect of the sanctity of Shabbat. And he doesn't go so far as to say, well, because it wasn't actually 7 days of creation, so I don't want to put that in his mouth. But I wonder. I wonder if part of the Radvaz's thinking is that, of course, we keep Shabbat in the day that Shabbat is, but is there a concept of Shabbos that kind of goes beyond that in terms of the value of a day of rest? And if someone doesn't actually know, so then actually has halachic implications. And so the Radvaz says this, and there are other later commentaries as well, someone named Rabbi Avram Danzig, the author of the Chaye Adam. He writes in his introduction to the laws of Shabbat, he says, yeah. He says, you know, we spend the entire week revolves around Shabbat. The 3 days before Shabbat, we prepare for Shabbat, then we observe Shabbat, and then we have the 3 days following Shabbat. And he says, why? Because each day partakes of the sanctity of Shabbos. And I'd like to suggest, is it possible that once we've come to the understanding that those 7 days of creation were not literal, of course we have the day of Shabbos, of course we have the weekday structure that we have, but does it have wider implications in terms of how we think of Shabbos as, yes, first and foremost, a day on which we rest, but also a larger concept? And if it's also a larger concept, it's not just, well, God rested on the seventh day, sort of this larger notion that there can be an intrinsic value to rest as part of our weekly cycle. Well, when people talk about nowadays, you hear all the time, the genius of the Jews. And Shabbos is in. It's really fascinating. I mean, it's amazing. You know, all these Hollywood celebrities, you got people all out there saying, wow, the Jews, Sabbath. That's like, it's amazing. They're blown away. If anyone's seen Senator Lieberman's book on the topic of Shabbat, all he recounts all these conversations with all these people, like, if only I could just get off for Shabbat. You know, I don't mean to say that there aren't other complications that come with it professionally, etc., but certainly there's a recognition now of the genius of the Jews. And so is there a way in which our understanding of the 7 days of creation is perhaps not literal, might have implications for understanding of the meaning of Shabbat? What I'd like to do is to suggest that there may be implications as well in terms of the concept of evolution. And I want to look at that a little bit together with the remainder of time that we have. And the first thing that I want to look at is going to be the question of, well, if we accept the concept of evolution, in other words, we're no longer saying, well, is Judaism consistent with this? Let's just accept it. Okay, so is that, as Rabbi Sachs perhaps would say, I asked him, but perhaps Rabbi Sachs would say, that's a separate, okay, so science does its thing, and Judaism does its thing. Or is it possible, as we'll see, that actually, based on the thought of Rav Kook in particular, that evolution has a positive contribution to offer to Jewish thought, or at least it can bring to our attention certain strands of thinking within Judaism that we might not have otherwise considered. Because it's been brought to kind of our attention that, you know what, this is really an interesting idea and we should reconsider. That's number one. And then number two, we'll see at the end, can that impact on how we read especially the creation of humanity at the end of the first chapter of Bereishis. So that's sort of what I want to do with the time remaining. Well, what happens next? That's what I want to look at. So what's fascinating is that even though Rav Kook lived more than 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, and I was saying we were vexed by these questions, he was obviously well ahead of his time. Rav Kook lives from the elder of Kook, Rav Avram Yitzchak Yehuda Cohen Kook, lives from 1865 to 1935, and he actually writes extensively. So he's living a little bit later. At this point, evolution is more widely accepted, and he has a series of comments in large measure based on his Kabbalistic understanding, and there's really a sort of a rationalist mystical distinction here that's extremely relevant. But for Rav Kook, he saw evolution as not only not anymore posing a problem to Judaism, he believed that it could be reconciled with Judaism, but he actually believed that this new insight that science had brought to the universe gave us a new appreciation and helped to confirm certain basic Jewish ideals. In particular, the notion that Rav Kook was very, very much attracted to, which is the idea that actually maybe we are growing somehow, not just in our terms of our physical strength, not just survival of the fittest and so on, but even in an ethical way, even in a moral way. Now, Rav Kook was incredibly optimistic, so this is consistent with his sort of approach. But he writes, for example, in Orot HaKodesh, one of his classic works in Source 3, evolution itself moving upwards from the lowest to the highest demonstrates most clearly a preset purpose for all existence. Right? Divine greatness is thereby enhanced, and all the goals of faith confirmed, and trust and service of the divine is all the more justified. Says Rav Kook, let's not only be defensive, let's consider this as an opportunity for renewed appreciation of what Judaism believes. And Rav Kook actually develops this in a whole series of different places, and it's part of this Kabbalistic worldview. He actually has this notion that we're actually somehow growing. He sees evolution, of course Darwin didn't necessarily mean it in this way, but there were many who took evolution originally as sort of blind belief in progress. That was sort of one of the classic ideas, and of course the tragedies of the 20th century kind of, you know, toned that down just a little bit. This notion that as we go along, there's just human progress at every stage along the way. That's not necessarily in vogue anymore the way that it was at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, World War I, World War II, they didn't do much for that sort of, you know, kind of a very rosy outlook in terms of progress. But that being said, Rav Kook really takes this idea and he really builds it up. There's some sort of human progress. And then I ask myself, wait a second, evolution teaches us something positive about human progress? I went to Jewish day school. I had that opportunity. And if you would have asked me, you know, as a kid, I'm going through, if you'd asked, you know, stop me, you know, say in the middle of the street or that classic thing, wake me up in the middle of the night and say, you know, say, do you believe or does Judaism believe that we are in a state of descent or ascent overall, right? That's such a simplistic question. I wouldn't ask it that way anymore. And I won't ask it to you in that way. We don't have to raise all of our hands. But honestly, if someone would have asked me that question, I would have said, well, everyone knows. I mean, there's this concept called Yiridat HaDorot, right? So the descent of the generations. Every generation away from Sinai is less and less. As we get further and further away, we become more distant and we become less connected. Isn't that how we understand why it is that, for example, we rule in favor of, if there's a debate among, for example, typically a rabbi at the time of the Mishnah versus the rabbi at the time of the Gemara? This is not the only theory as to why this is, but I always understood, this is sort of kind of my assumption, you know, well, the further you are from Sinai, the less spiritual you are. And where does that leave us today in 2020? Right? Nowhere good, right? I mean, we're just so distant, we're so far, and how can we even aspire? I've even heard students who have who have said, like, Rabbi, like, if Judaism really believes, I literally got this question, if Judaism really believes that we are, since we're so far from Sinai, we can't be so spiritual, can't be so religiously connected, so, like, you know, who can blame me if I'm struggling religiously? Like, that's, you know, that's something like, right, that's, we're too far from Sinai now. And so it almost, it can be misconstrued almost as sort of a way of saying, well, you know, we're downgraded nowadays and we really don't have the capacities of previous generations and so on and so forth. But that's always what I believed in. And it's not something that I invented. We know that there are real sources that back this idea of, if not spiritual evolution, that what we can call for tonight, spiritual devolution, right? Yiridat HaDorot. And sort of that notion that spiritual evolution is anathema to everything that we believe was something that I kind of took for granted. And there are many sources in the Gemara itself that seem to suggest this idea. Take a look at source number 4. Right? This is one of the colorful ones. Amar Masechet Shabbat and Daf Kuf Yudbet Amud Aleph Im Rishonim B'nei Malachim Anu B'nei Anashem. So this is like this is the good news. If the early generations are characterized as the sons of angels, we are the sons of men. But if the early generations are characterized as the sons of men, we're more akin to donkeys, right? Not exactly the most positive outlook on this generation. And this is just the Gemara itself talking about, I'm not sure exactly the timing of this particular statement, but talking about this generation relative to, who are the Rishonim here? And this is obviously not a reference to what we call the Rishonim nowadays, which would be from the year 1000 to 1500, because this is something that's Talmudic. So we're talking about whatever, you know, the period of the rabbis of the Mishnayot, the Tanaim, etc. Right? So clearly we're not necessarily, it's not even 100% clear what we're talking about, but it's probably just a few generations away. And yet the Gemara is completely dismissive of the present generation. And other Gemaras as well, we can cite others too. There's a Gemara on Masechet Brachos that talks about, that says, well, the early generations, they used to follow all the mitzvot to the, they didn't try to get any loopholes. It doesn't talk about Mechiras Chametz on Pesach. Although that's more of a recent phenomenon. It doesn't talk about Erev or other so-called loopholes in Judaism. But the Gemara says, well, for example, the Gemara says in previous generations they would make their, right, so I'm going to give you guys, we're learning brachos this year, so you guys can, I'm not going to call on you, but I'm sure you guys can recite it by heart. But there's actually in a Gemara that we're learning this year, the Gemara says that the earlier generations, they made their Torah primary and their work secondary, and the present generation is inverted, it's all backwards. And the previous generation, they would take their food and they would collect it from the fields and they would march it straight through the front door, because the halacha is that from a biblical perspective, the obligation of the maaser, of tithing the fruit, only takes effect when I go in the main entranceway of my home. So they would march right in so that they would have the obligation immediately. But now, Nebuch, we've gone down. I mean, imagine, there are other things to complain about. This is what the rabbis are saying. This is what they're doing. Nowadays, people take their food and they bring it in through the side door so that they don't have a biblical obligation. They only have a rabbinic obligation, and Rashi adds, and therefore they can snack on our food. It's the Judaism. It always goes back to getting a little bit of a bite to eat. So that's the explanation. So the Gemara says, bemoans this. Okay, so should always have such challenges in all generations, but the Gemara is trying to describe this notion, and we have many Gemaras about this idea and statements in among the rabbis about the notion of, you know, as we get further away and so we get more distant, etc. All of a sudden, comes Rav Kook and says, wait a second, if evolution is true, and we believe that, not that science and Torah have absolutely nothing to do with each other, but that science can reveal the mind of God, as it were. And that science can share with us a certain insight into how God created his universe. And we believe that there's sanctity and there's wisdom and insight that we can draw from that. Is it possible that we can then go back to this question and this knee-jerk reaction that I had? And I would have said, well, of course, as we get further from Sinai, of course it's true that we're just much less religious or spiritual, whatever you want to call it, than they used to be. Might we revisit that? Now you'll say, wait a second, we have all these Gemarot. But then, perhaps, I can't speak for Rav Kook, but if you were here, I don't know, but perhaps at least we're here, we can point to other texts that seem to cut in a very different direction. And can this notion of progress, but of spiritual progress, open our eyes to a different thread, or at least a more complex viewpoint in terms of how Judaism really views this issue of where we stand vis-a-vis the previous generations? Take a look at source number 5. Says the Gemara in Masechet Moed Katan. That's very interesting. I'd be very curious to hear what everyone thinks about this particular Gemara, this passage. Feel free to weigh in and jump in with your thoughts. The Gemara says, Sheshet alpayim shana havei ha'olam. Excuse me, Sheshet alafim shana havei ha'olam. The Gemara says, well, it's kind of ironic that I'm quoting this, of course, I realize that, right? The world is 6,000 years old, right? That's all we're going to get to, right? So 5780. By the way, there's a view that, according to many modern scholars, there were about 150 missing years, as it were, the quote-unquote missing years, 153, whatever exactly the number is. And if you add those to 5780, right, we're doing pretty well in terms of the messianic prediction, right? We're doing quite well, you know, The problem is that during the period of the medieval commentaries, they were constantly predicting the coming of Mashiach. There's a reason that the Rambam actually says enough with the all the predictions, because they were constantly incorrect. But this is there's some irony here. So the Gemara says, at 6,000 years of the world, Shnei Alafim Tohu, Shnei Alafim Torah, Shnei Alafim Yemot HaMashiach. Okay. Says the Gemara, the world exists for 6,000 years. For 2,000 years, there is chaos, tohu. Going back, of course, to the phrase we referenced earlier, for 2,000 years, for 2,000 years there is Torah. For 2,000 years are the days of Messiah. So let's do the math here. If we are thinking, what does it mean that 2,000 years is the period of Torah? According to the classical Jewish accounting, during what year was the Torah given? What was the year of Yetziat Mitzrayim and the giving of the Torah? Was 2448. That's the classical accounting. So what does the Gemara seem to be saying here? Well, we have 2,000 years of chaos. If I were to ask you, what kind of chaos are we talking about here? Is this physical chaos? How do you understand this concept of chaos here? Go ahead, please.
Pre-Torah,
good. So what kind, so there's something spiritual is lacking from the world. It's pre-Torah. So we could say that the tohu here in this Gemara, just at face value, is not talking about what it seemed to be talking about. The Gemara seems, in the psukim, in the first parak of Bereshit, in the opening psukim, it seems to be taking this idea of tohu and saying that tohu is actually a reference to some sort of primordial spiritual chaos, or almost a sense that we were lost. We didn't have our guidebook. We were lacking the Torah. So 2,000 years without the Torah, and then the Torah is given. 2,000 years of maybe the giving of the Torah. Maybe we go back, we can try to figure out the exact math. We go back to, let's say, Avraham Avinu or something around there. I think the exact years, but roughly, he's born in, what are they? I think say 1948, I think, right? So I always remember, what?
1948,
yes. It's a remark. Anyone ever remark on that? Someone's have a sermon on that somewhere. Anyone? According to the classic rabbinic accounting, Avraham Avinu was born in 1948, and right, at least that's how the math usually is worked out. And then you have your 1948. There's got to be something there. I don't know. Some rabbis to get it first. I don't know. Anyhow. Be that as it may, so if Avram's right there around the 2,000 year marks, it really starts to work out fairly nicely. That's the entry, at least, into the world of Torah. And then we have the 500 years that leading up to the giving of the Torah. And then you have the development of the written Torah, the development of the oral Torah. And then we can try to work out the exact timeline over here. But if I were to ask you on the whole, this source, 2,000 years of chaos, 2,000 years of Torah, 2,000 years of Mashiach. And now, what does that mean, 2,000 years of Mashiach? If we're now 5780, right? We missed the boat. Does anyone forget like within the last, you know, we got to go way back. You know, how do we understand this notion, 2,000 years of Mashiach, if we're now in 5780? How do you understand that? Any thoughts on that?
He's going to come at the end.
He's going to come at the end. So what? Okay. All right. So we're getting ready. Okay. We're on our way.
Another 200 and some years.
Okay. Wait a second. Hold on. If the Torah was given, and right at the beginning of the process of the giving of the Torah, or something akin to that, was the year from roughly 2,000 to 4,000. If we really take the Gemara in that way. What does it mean that, what happens during the 2,000 years leading up to the period of Mashiach? How do we understand that? So we just hang around, just kind of twiddle our thumbs?
Difficult times.
Maybe it's the Gemara talks often about the challenges that we'll face in some generations prior to Mashiach. Good, could be. The chutzpah yaske, the increase in disrespect and various other calamities, troubles, world wars and so on and so forth, we can suggest that. Rav Kook actually lived through World War I, not World War II. We actually thought World War I was the kind of the ikvata de Mashiach. That was his take on it. Right, what does this mean? Perhaps the years of the preparation for the Messiah? Well, right? That's how I may say. Go ahead.
That could be the beginning of Mashiach ben Yosef as opposed to Mashiach ben David.
Okay, good. Mashiach ben Yosef. Interesting. So that's the sort of order, depending on how you understand, it's the beginning of the project. Mashiach. That would be another way of saying that it's the beginning of the process, 100%. I'm speaking of 1948, or speaking of Zionism, Rav Kook has another piece, a classic eulogy for Herzl, which he suggests he identifies Herzl as the material Mashiach ben Yosef, when he sees the physical, not the spiritual side, and then you have Mashiach ben David. It's interesting to think about it in that context. Could be, is it the preparation for the coming of Mashiach? Right? Whatever it is, however exactly we understand this Gemara, it seems that one thing is clear to me, right? I don't understand a lot about this Gemara, just like I don't understand a lot about the details of the first parak of Bereishit. That much I'd be the first one to say. But what it does sound like the Gemara is saying is that is there evolution or devolution? What would you say?
They both exist together.
They both exist together.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, but if the first 2,000 years are spiritual chaos, okay, and then we have 2,000 years of Torah and 2,000 years of Mashiach. So how do you understand that? Now, I'm a big, I like learning, I'm into Torah, I'm a very big fan. But I was like kind of my, if you do the knee-jerk test, at least on me, I would say the time of Torah versus the time of Mashiach. I would say the time of Mashiach is instinctively, I would just say, the time of Mashiach is meant to convey or represent a higher level of spiritual achievement. So if that's the case, right, is this Gemara not suggesting spiritual evolution? I mean, if we were to graph it over here, this is actually beautifully appropriate. Yerushalayim, right? We have the coming of Mashiach, right? If we were to graph it, would we not think that we start, it's really the opposite. Is there spiritual evolution? So wait a second. We have the Gemara in Shabbos. We have many sources that are telling us that actually we're getting more distant from Sinai and therefore lower in terms of our level of spirituality. So that's the classic idea. But then we have this Gemara that seems to suggest that there's some sort of spiritual evolution. And after all, if we believe that the coming of Mashiach will come not in context of some of our sins, but there's a possibility that it will come in context of our spiritual achievements, does not imply that there's some sort of growth. Mark?
No.
Question? Oh, I thought you're just like the student that I think has a question. Good. So yes, please.
At the same time that you're having this tremendous evolution of Torah mm-hmm. being taught all over the world, you also have a tremendous amount of yin that are going away from Yiddishkeit.
Right?
So that's why I'm saying evolution and evolution at the same time.
So you're saying you put the different sources together, we can kind of see them together. And I think that there's, and I want to build on this a little bit and kind of push it forward. Take a look, for example, at source number 6. This is a responsum of the Tosfos Rid. Tosfos Rid is a great Italian scholar living during the medieval period, and he's trying to account for the phenomenon. It's a very practical halachic phenomenon, which is that on the one hand we say that it's true that the earlier generations maybe are closer to Sinai, but yet at the same time, if there's a debate between a later scholar and an earlier scholar, at least, and there's a debate as to the scope of this principle, the Gemara said, the general principle is, the Gemara already says, that Hilchita Kibatz Ra'i, right? That the law follows, but actually, if there is, at least, for example, within the Amoraic period, within the rabbis of the time of the Gemara, if there's a debate, right? If you have Ravina and Ravashi, who are traditionally considered to be the compilers of the Gemara, and they debate with earlier scholars, whom do we follow as a matter of practical halacha? In this case, we actually follow the later scholars. That seems, what do you mean? Why is it Hilchata Kibatzra'i? Why do we follow the later scholars? It's very strange. And he explains, well, because we are nanasim rechuvim al tzavreha anakim, we are dwarfs riding on the backs of giants. Right? This is that classic image. You find this elsewhere. It's a classic medieval almost motif. We're dwarfs riding on the backs of giants. Like, this is his way of trying to somehow reconcile and say, well, we can have one and we can have the other at the same time. Is it possible that we're spiritually maybe lower than previous generations, but what do we at least have? We have the, right, we have the insights of previous generations. This is not how human wisdom works. This is not how science works. This is not how very much of what we have know nowadays really works in that way. And the truth is, our understanding of Tanakh works this way. Our understanding of Judaism, in some ways at least, works in this way, because there are new insights that we can gain in new generations. Right? So that's one suggestion. Huh? Okay.
And we have art scrolls.
And we have Art Scroll, okay? Siyum Hashas. We have the Art Scroll. We have now the Koran. We have what else? We have the Rabbi Google to be accurate about it. We have the Oldaf. Anyone have that app? Anyone using it? I think so. We have Oldaf is the OU's new app for all your different Daf Yomi, and it's a one-stop shop. It's unbelievable. So you have this. You have all these technologies now. So that's one attempt to reconcile. Say, you know what? Actually, we can have our cake and we can eat it too. And we have other suggestions. I'm not going to spend too much time on them, but just very quickly, you have other, especially Hasidic thinkers, who wanted to say that since the time of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, there's a new revelation. Right? So what they say, well, that's much more recent. So how do we square that again with the notion of the spiritual devolution? Right? We're so distant from Sinai, etc. So for example, Rav Sadok HaKohen Milublin lives from 1823 to 1900. Fascinating biography. He actually started as a misnaged. He started off as an anti-Hasid from a very staunch anti-Hasidic family, and then he becomes enamored with the Hasidic movement, and he comes transformed as a fascinating personality. And he has a passage in which he says that every soul in Israel has its own special force in holiness, is the number of generations that have already passed, so is the number of holy forces and words of Torah that have been revealed in the world. Therefore, in each and every generation, holiness becomes ever more revealed, even though the generations are in decline, as is well known. Right? If you take a look at the Hebrew as languages, he says, well, we have new elements of Kedusha. He says, if you look at the second line in the Hebrew, therefore, in every generation, the sanctity is even more evident. Even though it's true that we know that there is this notion of the lowering of the generations. So again, he's trying to somehow say, you know what? Let's not take for granted this notion that all the generations are declining. Maybe it's possible that somehow we can balance these two. And there are other suggestions as well. If you look at, I'm not going to go into depth, but if you take a look at source number 8, this is what I call the parabola theory. And so if you think about it, so we're going like this. I'm very removed from math, so I'm way out of my league right now. I'm just going to put this out there. So the parabola, don't ask me to explain the significance of parabola. Maybe I can still do, but really beyond that, I really have to do some chazar. Sometimes I see students and they ask me, Rabbi, can you help me with my test? I say, what's the subject? And they say math. I say, I promise you. I promise you. Just I'm happy to be helpful elsewhere. But this might not be my area. But the basic shape of a parabola, right, is a very interesting one to think about. This is a source of Pinchas Mikoretz. He basically tries to suggest, and this is kind of based on the trope that the Middle Ages was maybe a lesser, was kind of what they call the Dark Ages, and we can debate whether or not that's actually an accurate representation of the Middle Ages, but he actually wants to suggest that, well, at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, he says, HaTanoim v'Amoraim, he says, what, the Tanoim and Amoraim, the rabbis at the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara, says they were very close to the time, they were very spiritually connected. They were still close to, they had some sense, they had some way of connecting to the temple. He says, in his own way, I'm going to have my cake and eat it too. He says, the Tanaim Namorayim, he says, they, the rabbis, the Mishnah, the Gemara, were close in time to the destruction of the temple, which still gave illumination, right? So they're higher up, having only recently been removed. And then he says, and then you go down from there. And then he says, and then the recent tzaddikim, these generations are close to the light of Mashiach, right? Almost echoes of the Gemara in Moed Katan that we saw, right? Going back up. But the scholars of the Middle Ages were far removed from the destruction of the temple and also far removed from the Messiah, and therefore did not attain a high spiritual level. The parabola theory of, right, so starting from a high level and then a lower level and then coming back up at the time of Mashiach. Now, I don't know which of these theories is correct, and I think that the real answer is, like most things in real life, it's complicated. And I think we all know that in the end of the day. But I think that the first and the major insight that we've seen so far, and then I want to add just one more, is that essentially what we see here is the notion that if previously we thought that evolution, okay, we can square it with Judaism, can it at least open our eyes to ask new questions, to have a new appreciation? Maybe it's not all that simple. Maybe it's not as simple as, okay, we're far away from Sinai and therefore we're worthless. Maybe it's a little bit more complicated. Maybe there are new revelations, there are new insights that we can gain, even as, yes, there are very significant challenges in this generation without a question, but maybe we don't have to feel that we're completely distant and that there is an aspect or a direction in Jewish thought following Rav Kook to see evolution as teaching us that, you know what, we have something special to offer and to achieve and to discover as well. And if we are closer to Mashiach, then maybe we do have a certain insight. And maybe the Gemara Moikatan should be brought to the fore, and we should consider this as part of as we answer the question. I don't think there's one clear answer to the question of, you know, the decline and the incline of the generations. All I mean to say is that Rav Kook and evolution suggest to us that maybe we have a little bit more to offer than we might have otherwise thought. That's number one. And then the second point and the final point, and this is going to be just one insight in terms of just one example of what would it mean to take this idea and to apply it to the text of Bereishit. And then a quick thought from Rabbi Sachs, and then we'll be on our way and get more of the food that we have. It's very interesting. If it's true that we no longer have to feel compelled to read the book of, or the chapter, the opening chapter of Bereishit, as centering on the question of, okay, how do we reconcile Torah and science, right? The Big Bang and all these kinds of things. Does that open up new opportunities for us to look fresh at the first parak of Bereishit? Does that give us a new opportunity to think about, what does this really mean to teach us? And what can we learn from the story of creation as it's presented? If it's not just about, right, if we're not just trying to figure out the scientific aspects of it and how does it accord with science, so what new insights can we gain? And it's very interesting to think about this in context of evolution, because one of the greatest fears of many religious thinkers is that after Darwin put forward the idea of the evolution of species, that we were, in the words of someone who was a lord even before Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, Lord Alfred Tennyson, he was a great poet in the 19th century. Apparently, Her Majesty believes there can be more than one lord. I don't know. We don't necessarily hold from that, but I don't know. I can go to Canada and I can inquire and see what they have to say. Be that as it may, what insight they have to share. Be that as it may, though, that he wrote in a classic poem, In Memoriam, he writes that, according, based on Darwinism, humanity is red in tooth and claw. Red in tooth and claw. Now, what does that mean? Essentially, that we've almost justified violence. I mean, we're bathed in violence, and that's really the only way that any animals or humans have really made it through. And so it became this fear that we're going to somehow justify violence. And the truth is, although the Torah doesn't obviously explicate a notion of evolution, it does two things in Perek Aleph of Bereishit. Number one, clearly there is a movement over the course of the first 6 days of creation from lower to higher forms of being. We have the animals, right? So we have a number of animals that we find beginning in the third day of creation, and then to the fourth day of creation to the fifth day of creation, and then you get higher and higher order until you come to Tzelem Elokim, until you come to humanity, right? So you have this notion of some sort of ascent. And then the Torah tells us, instructs humanity, number one, you're created Bitzelem Elokim, the image of God, so we're superior to the animals, that's first. Number two, Uridu vidgat hayom, and in addition to pru revu, be fruitful and multiply, which is told to the fish as well, uridu vidgat hayom uva'ofa shamayim. What are we instructed to do? We are uridu, we are going to become the masters, right? Also, we learn v'chiv shuha, and conquer it. Conquer the world. Red in tooth and claw. Sure, what it sounds like to me at first glance, right? The Torah puts forward this idea that we are almost, you know, in charge. And I think it opens up the question, what do we do with that path? What do we do with that? What's fascinating is the end of the first parak of Bereishit. The first parak of Bereishit concludes not with the power of humanity, but actually, anyone know, with our diet. with their diet. Unexpectedly. Like, we're going through the whole creation, and we're going to be masters. And by the way, in case you were wondering, humans are allowed to eat. What does it say? Adam was. Okay? So you can think this is a popular or non-popular idea, but it's there. The Gemara in Sanhedrin confirms it for us. Adam HaRishon was a vegetarian, okay? You can eat from the fruits of the trees, you can eat from vegetation, although the lower level animals were allowed to eat only the vegetation, but still. So first, what do we find? We find you're going to rule over all the animals, the domesticated animals, the undomesticated animals, the birds, fish, etc. You're going to rule over all of them. And then immediately afterward, what does the Torah say? You can't eat them. I don't even know what it means. I can't eat them. What do you mean? You just told me I'm master over them. Apparently, there's a difference, and we can understand that difference. There's a difference between gaining mastery over the physical world versus actually going ahead and eating them. But I think the Torah is actually meaning to teach us something quite profound. I think the Torah is teaching us that just because we believe, and we can say it in these terms nowadays, even if we accept the principles of evolution, granted, but not everything that happens in nature is necessarily the way that we ought to hold ourselves in terms of our moral obligations. With the accomplishments of humanity, with us being the strongest, most accomplished being, essentially, on planet Earth, with that great power, not to be cliche about it, comes great responsibility. And in fact, is it possible that if we usually read Bereishit Perek Aleph only about the, in context of the science list, that's how I always did, but now we can read it as moving forward, as setting into motion a completely new understanding of what the first section of Sefer Bereishit is really all about. Is it perhaps about the responsibilities that come along with the mastery, with the power of what it means to be a human being? Is it possible that Perek Bet of Bereishit, Gan Eden, Le'ovda u'lishomra, that yes, we have the capacity and the obligation and we have the unique opportunity to be nestled in the Garden of Eden together with God, and yet at the same time, we have an obligation to work for our own keep, but more than that, to work and to preserve. And Rabbi Sacks suggests, and this is what I want to close with, he suggests that this might be actually the overarching sort of theme that runs throughout, and this is something that I'm exploring now with our students as well. Rabbi Sacks essentially suggests that if you think about Sefer Bereishit, there are actually, talk about the major narratives after the creation of humanity. What do we have? We have Adam and Chava and Gan Eden. What do we have right after that? Right after that, we have, we have the story of, okay, we're going to get to right Migdal Bavel. We're gonna come to. Excellent, very good. We have Cain and Hevel, right? So we have the story of Adam and Chava and Gan Eden. We have Cain and Hevel. What's the next major sin and punishment? We have the generation of the flood, Dor HaMabel, and then indeed the conclusion. We have Migdal Bavel. He says, what's going on over here? And then we have Avraham Avinu. This is the first 11 chapters. This is almost a unit. He says, what is happening over here? Suggests Rabbi Sacks, it's all about the notion of the responsibilities of humanity. He says the first kind of responsibility is personal responsibility. Right? That essentially is the story of Adam and Chava. It's not engaging the victim culture. It's not saying, oh, it was their fault. They got me to do it. The other one got me to do it. It's personal responsibility. That's the first thing. That still remains a challenge, I think, for us in today's world. That's number one. Second one is moral responsibility, he says. That's Cain and Hevel. He says, Cain doesn't say, well, someone else caused me to do it. He says, well, am I my brother's keeper? Right? Hevel Achicha, where's Hevel your brother? He says, well, I don't know, it's not my responsibility. It's a personal responsibility. Then we have moral responsibility. And then we come to the story of, right? We come to the story of the Mabel. And what's the story of the Mabel? Is the obligation, right? And what was Noach's whole shortcoming? Noach's whole shortcoming, according to the rabbis, was that he was concerned for his own, but he wasn't genuinely concerned with the world out there. What our responsibility is not only to our own and to morality, but to civilization, collective responsibility, Rabbi Sacks calls it. And then finally, do we only answer to ourselves and everyone around us, or do we answer to a higher calling? Rabbi Sacks puts it in this way. What we see in Genesis 1 to 11 is an exceptionally tightly constructed four-act drama on the theme of responsibility and moral development, presenting the maturation of humanity as echoing the maturation of the individual. First thing we learn as children is that our acts are under our control, personal responsibility. That's the story of Gan Eden, Adam and Chava. The next is that not everything that we can do, we may do. moral responsibility. And I would suggest that this is all anchored in Bereshit Perek Aleph. The next stage is the realization is that we have a duty not just ourselves, but to those on whom we have an influence, collective responsibility, the story of Noach and the Teva. Ultimately, we learn that morality is not mere human convention, but is written into the structure of existence. There is an author of being, therefore there's an authority beyond mankind to whom, when acting morally, we respond. In other words, Migdal Bavel, right? We're going to bring a tower and think that we are the authors of our moral destiny or moral obligations, but ultimately it goes back to God. And so I think ultimately what we emerge with is really this complete paradigm shift. If we take a look at the concept of science and Judaism, and we now have come to accept that they are compatible, we can take that step further. We can suggest that evolution opens our eyes to maybe another aspect of Jewish philosophy, and maybe the whole question of the ascent and the descent of the generations maybe it's a little bit more complex than at least I was raised to understand. And maybe there's something unique that we have to offer, even as we, of course, have that reverence for previous generations to recognize our distance from Har Sinai. More than that, are there new insights we can gain into Bereshit Perek Aleph? Maybe Bereshit Perek Aleph is teaching us a fundamental principle. Yes, you have mastery over all the animals. But with that power comes that responsibility. And that leads us into the four major parts, the four major narratives that essentially frame this prehistory, in other words, the pre-Abrahamic history that come before the 2,000 years of Torah. Those years of spiritual chaos are meant to teach humanity exactly this notion of responsibility. And so I think that the opportunities that stand before us are really extraordinary, not just in terms of ability to reconcile Torah and science, but to think collectively about how this might allow us to read Bereshit and to read really Judaism as a whole in new light and go back to our original sources and gain new, deeper appreciation for what it is that the Torah is trying to teach us, what it is that our rabbis are trying to teach us. I thank everyone for your time. Wish everyone a Shavua Tov. I'm happy to stay. I don't want to keep everyone from the food. So if anyone has any questions, I'll invite this anyone up. I don't know if there's anything that you want to conclude with, but I want to keep it. Thank you. I think the question is, I'm going to keep you. It's
sure. Already, yeah. Yeah, no. I want to thank both the Rutners and for Rabbi Sininsky for a wonderful evening. Just two quick announcements. One, the men's clubs of ABJ and D and Or Torah are having an event this coming Wednesday night at 7:30. It's on retirement. It's a seminar on retirement planning income or getting your income for retirement planning. If you want to come, please see me. Please RSVP. Also, this coming Sunday night, the Adult Education Committee of Congregation ABJ&D is sponsoring Brett Stevens. Greg knows all the details of that. I don't have it in front of me, but if you can make it, that would be great as well. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Good. One second.